As I was saying 4 days and 29 years ago, thank you. Between the banquet in Kansas City, where I received what my family currently refers to as Newbery One, and this evening's glorious celebration for the award we are calling Newbery II, you have taken me on a journey. You invited me to many places. They were places where I could have grown-up conversations, places where I could shed the burden of my personal self and become part of the community of children's books. And those places became my third place. The third place is where we go that is neither work nor home. It is where we are taught to measure up in a different way from home and from work. The third place is the destination of people who want to meet, to mingle, and to participate both as individuals and as part of a community. It is a place where we feel accepted for ourselves and where we learn to conduct ourselves as grown-up members of a larger community. The third place attaches us to the human tradition. Civilized society has always had a third place. It is as ancient as the Agora of Greece, where Socrates walked among the youth of Athens. It is as old as the Forum in Rome, where Mark Antony came to praise Caesar. The Middle Ages had the church, the Renaissance, the piazza. At the turn of the century, Vienna had its coffee houses. Between two world wars, New York City held the Algonquin for the New Yorkers, and Paris had Shakespeare and Company for the expatriates. And after the wars, there was the Café des Deux Magots for the existentialists. Ireland has its pub, England its club. Colonial America had its town square. Suburban America has what? The workout center? The sports bar? Could it be Barnes and Noble? I don't know if suburban America even has a third place, but I do. I have a third place, and it is the one you opened for me after Newbery One and have kept open ever since. My first third place was Cleveland. The Ohio Association of School Librarians was meeting there at a time when Dorothy Broderick was on the faculty at Case Western Reserve in their School of Library Science of blessed memory. Broderick was scheduled to be in the audience when I spoke. The third place demands that we test ourselves, and I knew that this audience would not have much patience with an author ramble, a talk that was not properly dressed as discourse. So I extended the thoughts of my Newbery address, wherein I had spoken about my love of words, and I spoke about language and how language is God's gift to us as humans and how we must take care of it as we would any treasure, for it not only reflects our culture but also helps to shape it. Language demands being treated with dignity. It makes demands, but it also delivers rewards, for precise language helps shape precise thinking. The third place also makes demands, and it also delivers. From the third place, we give something, and we take something, and we return with our lessons transplanted and transformed. From the Agora, Plato took the teachings of Socrates and returned with the Academy. From the Piazza della Signoria in Florence, Michelangelo took the spirit of the Renaissance and returned it in the heroic figure of David. To my surprise and delight, I have found traces of my third places in the view from Saturday. Here is how the echo of that talk on language plays back. It is the day before the contest with Knightsbridge for the district championship of the Middle School Academic Bowl. Mr. Connor Ledoux, the principal, visits Mrs. Olinsky, the Epiphany coach, and says, "I heard a rumor that your team is expecting to blow mine out of the water." His smile was as genuine as his Xerox signature. "I told our coach that she could expect to be hung if she lets your sixth-grade grunges beat us out." "Well, then," Mrs. Olinsky replied, "much as I respect your coach, I recommend that you start buying rope." She added, "By the way, Mr. Ledoux, in our grunge neighborhood, we say hanged, not hung. Check it out." The first call I ever received from a reader of my published work was from Amy Kelman, a children's librarian who lived in Rye, New York, the town neighboring Port Chester where we lived at the time. Both Amy and I had once called Pittsburgh home. In 1976, when I was invited to speak at the Fall Festival of Children's Books in Pittsburgh, Amy had returned and was at the Carnegie Library there, but I had moved to Florida. So Pittsburgh was now a third place for me. The third place is where we go to talk about what is current, but not necessarily quotidian. In our bicentennial year, the classics of children's literature were being re-reviewed for political correctness. Language that was once merely colorful was being attacked as racist or sexist or both. The third place is where we learn to listen to different voices and where we learn how to agree to disagree. So in the auditorium of that great Carnegie Library on Forbes Street in Pittsburgh, I talked about how important it is to maintain color in children's literature, that true diversity does not prescribe, proscribe, or circumscribe language, and that for the sake of accuracy as well as poetry, it is best not to skew or skewer language to be current or be politically correct. And I found that those thoughts, too, have surfaced in The View from Saturday. Mrs. Eva Marie Olinsky always gave good answers. Whenever she was asked how she had selected her team for the academic bowl, she chose one of several good answers. Most often she said that the four members of her team had skills that balanced one another. That was reasonable. Sometimes she said that she knew her team would practice. That was accurate. To the district superintendent of schools, she gave a bad answer, but she did that only once, only to him, and if that answer was not good, her reason for giving it was. Mrs. Olinsky's bad answer is her response to political correctness. Part of that fall festival was the dedication of the Elizabeth Nesbitt Room. That's Nesbitt with two T's, named for a children's librarian, not a children's book writer. In the wonderful way that the world of children's books has of circling back on itself, the third place that Pittsburgh had become has once again become home, for the Elizabeth Nesbitt Room in the Library School at the University of Pittsburgh is now home to my manuscripts and illustrations. Pat Scales and I met over the telephone when her students at Greenville Middle School called me for an author interview. The degree of preparation, the quality of the questions, and the courtesy of that interview were prelude to not only another third place, but to a friendship as well. It was upon the recommendation of Pat Scales that I was invited to address a joint conference of the Southeastern and Southwestern Library Associations when they met in New Orleans. New Orleans is an American city that retains a downtown. As I grew up in small towns in Pennsylvania, downtown was the third place for town folk, but it was also home for me, because we almost always lived over the store. I thought about the homes I had known as a child. I thought about how I had always looked for home in the books I read, and how I still look for home in the books I read. I talked about that and about how, now that I am grown up, I have a chance to create homes in the books I write. All of us long for home. Nadia's story in The View from Saturday is about that. Her need for finding home is there when she says that her mother moved the two of them from Florida to upstate New York, where she had grown up, because she needed some autumn in her life. And it is there in Nadia's account of how the turtles, after decades of absence, return to their home shore to nest. My friendship with Pat Scales that began with a telephone call is maintained by phone, and our late-night long-distance calls have come to qualify as a third place, for sometimes sooner, sometimes later, but always, our conversation gets around to what is current in children's books. But we usually begin our marathon phone visits by talking about home. We discovered that we have a lot in common. We were both raised by Jewish mothers, even though Pat's Jewish mother happens to be a Methodist. We are both middle child, and we both have an older sister. During one long call, Pat told me about her sister's taking the family dog to an audition for the part of Sandy in the play Annie. Daisy not only got the part, she made the front page above the fold of the leisure section of the Anderson, South Carolina Independent Mail. Pat sent me the clipping. I still have it in my files. It is dated September 15, 1983. Daisy is now in dog heaven, enjoying the company of other celebrities like Lassie, Rin Tin Tin, and Toto. but I hope those other stars realize that unlike them, Daisy led the life of a real dog and was the inspiration for a character named Ginger. I wish Daisy a long afterlife in Julian's story when Ginger played Annie Sandy. Simmons College was my next third place. The theme of the Institute that summer was, Do I Dare Disturb the Universe? I thought about how every creative act disturbs the universe and how every creative act requires risk. Addressing the theme, I used the example of Galileo to show that those who dare disturb the universe must first have the courage to dare disturb the neighborhood. It sometimes takes more courage to disturb the neighborhood than it takes to disturb the universe. I discovered that kind of courage in Julian Singh. At the state finals of the Academic Bowl, the Commissioner of Education reads the question. An acronym is defined as a word formed from the initial letters of a series of words. Can you give me two examples of acronyms that have entered our language as words? Julian answers POSH and TIP. The commissioner looked over his list of possible answers. POSH and TIP, he asked. Julian quickly answered. POSH means fashionable and is the acronym for Port Out Starboard Home, and TIP, meaning the small sum of money given for services rendered, is the acronym for To Ensure Promptness. The commissioner laughed. Oh, I don't have either of those acronyms on my list. We'll have to check with our advisory panel. He nodded to the three people sitting at the table on the far side of the room. The three of them conferred briefly and passed a note to the commissioner. We can allow POSH, but we don't find a reference for TIP, Julian said. With all due respect, sir, I think you ought to check another source. In The View from Saturday, Mrs. Olinsky says, sometimes to be successful, you have to risk making mistakes, and sometimes we even have to risk making fools of ourselves. The structure of The View from Saturday was a risk. The third place is where we learn to take risks. Newbery Banquets is where we learn whether or not we have made fools of ourselves. It is in the third place that we learn to wear a mask or risk taking one off, because it is here that we learn to identify or not identify with people whose lives are not our own. 1989 was designated the Year of the Young Reader. The Florida Center for the Book invited me to speak at a conference on writing for young readers. I gave a talk entitled The Mask Beneath the Face. I believe that a writer wears a mask every time she sits down to write, and readers try on masks every time they read. I also believe that children design the masks they will wear by the time they finish sixth grade. In that talk, I asked my husband, the psychologist, Dr. David Konigsberg, do you think wearing a mask allows a person to be someone else, or do you think that a mask allows a person to be that which he really is? And my husband, the psychologist, Dr. David Konigsberg, answered, yes. Now listen to what Ethan Potter, a sixth grade soul, has to say in The View from Saturday. It was dark when I left Sillington House. Mrs. Gershom had offered to drive me home, but I wanted to walk. I wanted to walk the road between Sillington House and mine. I wanted to mark the distance slowly. Something had happened at Sillington House. Something made me pull sounds out of my silence the way that Julian pulled puzzle pieces out of Nadia's hair. Had I gained something at Sillington House, or had I lost something there? The answer was yes. Maureen Hayes, Mo of blessed memory, recommended that even though I was going to Rochester, New York on a different assignment, I ought to speak to an assembly of children's librarians there. Mo was an extraordinary matchmaker, the Dolly Levi of author appearances. She knew that I needed to meet Julie Cummins, who was children's services consultant in Rochester at the time. Following our meeting, Julie, a few other librarians, and I went to lunch. This was not the Café des Deux Magots, and this was not the round table at the Algonquin. This was better. Not even the chocolate dessert was as rich and savory as our conversation. In 1992, Julie Cummins was at New York Public, and she invited me to give the Ann Carroll Moore lecture. It was here that I chose to explore the relationship between reading and the brain. I learned that the human brain must be jump-started with experience. For example, a baby kept blindfolded may have all his equipment in perfect order, but will never function as a seeing person, even when the blindfold is removed, because the pathways that allow him to interpret what he sees will not have been carved out. Experience is necessary to start function, and more experience is necessary to refine it. A child must see in order to be able to see. A child must speak in order to speak. I also learned that there is for each of these senses a critical age by which these nerve pathways must be carved out if they are ever to be reinforced. For most developing brains, that critical age comes before adolescence. I came to believe that there is a critical age for establishing the nerve pathways that allow us to interpret the printed word. We must read in order to read. I found those thoughts, that the human brain must be jump-started with experience, as well as the thought that there is a critical age for experience to shape our brains, translated in the view from Saturday. But here, it is an emotion that must be experienced to be expressed. After the state championship of the academic bowl has been decided, Mrs. Olinsky and Mr. Singh are driving home from the state capitol, and Mr. Singh speaks. How can you know what is missing if you've never met it? You must know of something's existence before you can notice its absence. So it was with the souls. They found on their journeys what you found at Sillington House. A cup of kindness, Mr. Singh? Is that what I found? Kindness, yes, Mrs. Olinsky. Noah, Nadia, and Ethan found kindness in others and learned how to look for it in themselves. Can you know excellence if you've never seen it? Can you know good if you have only seen bad? A person must experience kindness to recognize it. He must recognize it in order to develop it. Being kind makes us kind. And just as there is a critical age by which we must speak in order to speak, there is a critical age by which we must experience kindness to be kind. And that critical age is before adolescence. That critical age is in the cruelest year, grade 6. There are some third places where I have been 3 times. Call them an exponential 3 or 3 to the 3rd power. These 3 times third places have all been very kind to me. I have been to Oklahoma and I have been to Maine 3 times. Conversations with Donna Skvarla in the former and Mary Preverata in the latter reassured me that a writer can trust the kindness of readers. Librarians who work with children as well as books know that young readers want to connect and are willing to reach down and up and into a book that has more to it than meets the eye. Herb Sandberg and Hughes Moore invited me to the University of Toledo 3 times. And each time I went, I met not only with kindness at that university, but also with kindness in the community. For through their efforts, the Children's Literature Institute has become a third place for the people of the town. Every year, lay citizens support the Institute by participating in the events, both social and educational. In Toledo, I learned to trust an informed community. Herb Sandberg knows that an informed community fears its children's not finding books more than it fears what they might find in them. I met Ethel Ambrose in the mid-70s when she and Esther Franklin invited me to their Stockton-Sacramento gig. Ethel left California for Little Rock, Arkansas, and where Ethel goes, a children's literature festival follows. On one of those days in Little Rock, I was in Ethel's office signing books when the custodian came in to read up, as we ex-Pennsylvanians say. Out of sheer enthusiasm, Ethel picked up a copy of one of my books and began to read it out loud. She had hardly turned a page before the young man had bought the book. He had to, of course. Whether he had children or not, he had to. Ethel Ambrose's enthusiasms are not to be denied, and neither is her commitment to excellence. There is no greater kindness to readers or to writers than the commitment to excellence of an outstanding children's librarian. The third place is neither work nor home, but would have little meaning without them. Had I not found trust and kindness at a critical time at work, would I ever have been able to recognize them in the third place? Jean Carl has been my editor since she took a risk on a manuscript called Jennifer Hecate Macbeth, William McKinley, and Me Elizabeth that had come in over the transom. We have worked together on 18 books since, and she has never been less than brilliant as an editor. Over the course of our association, through waves of political no-nos, Jean has demonstrated such intellectual integrity that never once has she asked me to shape my text to the times. That is trust. Thank you, Jean Carl. It is John Landman, as editorial director, whose understanding of the head of an author as well as the head of a publishing house has maintained the flow of thought as well as the flow of paper from manuscript to bound book. His understanding of the bookmaking process borders on the Talmudic. If genius is an infinite capacity for taking pains, John is a genius, and he is kind. Thank you, John. I believe that courtesy is the threshold to kindness, and I believe that courtesy begins at home, in the first place. And I also believe that in a 45-year-old relationship, courtesy is no longer the threshold to kindness, but is maintenance. And in a 45-year-old empty nest relationship, courtesy is mandatory. And in a 45-year-old empty nest relationship where one's husband is one's agent, courtesy is a miracle. But I'm here to tell you, miracles do happen. Thank you, David, for the pretty thing our years together have been. In the 30 years since my first books were published, the children of our children are now the same age that Paul, Laurie, and Ross were in 1968, a little in-house guarantee for a long shelf life for one's books. Thank you, kids. In his 1997 State of the Union message, President Clinton said, "As the internet becomes our new town square, we need a computer in every home. The internet may be the new town square, but it can never be my third place. The third place is community. The internet is isolation. The third place is dress up. The internet is dressed down. The third place is learning to interpret a wink, a blink, a flick of the hand. The internet is learning to keyboard. The internet is not a third place. But I discovered that Sillington House is." In The View from Saturday, when Ethan Potter tells his story, he says, "Something in Sillington House gave me permission to do things I had never done before, never even thought of doing. Something there triggered the unfolding of those parts that had been incubating, things that had lain inside me curled up like turtle hatchlings newly emerged from their eggs, taking time in the dark of their nest to unfurl themselves. I told jokes I had never told before. I asked questions I had never asked before." In The View from Saturday, I told a story I had never told before. For Sillington House is not only the third place for Ethan and the Souls and Mrs. Olinsky. It is my return on the third place you have given me. It is my statue returned to the piazza. It is my rendering of the place you gave me to see in order to see, the place you gave me to speak in order to speak. Ethan again. One Saturday afternoon, as we sat around the table for four where we had had our tea, I broke the silence by asking, I really don't know why, except that it was something I had been thinking about. If you could live one day of your life all over again, what day would it be? When it was my turn to tell what day I would like to live over, the Souls were not embarrassed to hear, and I was not embarrassed to say, I would like to live over the day of our first tea party. And look, I added, every Saturday since, I get to do just that. Now, in a paraphrase of Ethan Potter's desire, I am not embarrassed to say, and you are not embarrassed to hear, I would like to live over the evening of my first Newbury party. And look, I can add, after a fulfilling 29 years, I get to do just that. Thank you, John Edward Peters. I love all your names and all the members of the 1997 committee. I love all your names too. Thank you for letting me do just that. Thank you, members of the American Library Association, for then. Thank you for now. Thank you forever.